Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. In this podcast, we interview policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create a brighter future for every Washington student. Dr. Tukwila Brownie is Executive Vice President of Strategy, Policy, and Community Coalitions at TNTP, a national nonprofit founded by teachers that works at every level of the public education system to attract and train talented teachers and school leaders, ensure rigorous and engaging classrooms, and create environments that prioritize great teaching and accelerate student learning. Their website is tntp.org. TNTP currently works with South Shore Pre-K through 8 in South Seattle, a close partner of League of Education Voters. As Executive Vice President, Dr. Brownie leads TNTP's Strategy, Policy, and Community Coalitions Division. Her team's work is focused on improving local and national student outcomes and disrupting educational inequities to ensure all students are afforded an opportunity to be successful. Previously, Tukwila served as both Executive Vice President and Vice President, leading TNTP's work with school districts to design integrated approaches to talent and academics. Before joining TNTP, Tukwila worked for 9 years in Memphis City Schools, where she oversaw the district-wide effort to improve student outcomes by increasing teacher effectiveness. Working alongside TNTP staff, Tukwila helped build community support for quality education and drove human capital reforms that led to significant policy changes. Tukwila is also a licensed therapist and worked as a school social worker, where her focus was on supporting students and families' efforts to improve academic and social outcomes. She serves on several local and national boards, including Education Leaders of Color, Stand for Children National Board, Kip Delta Arkansas School Board, and Memphis Seating Success Strive Network. Tukwila, TNTP released a groundbreaking report titled The Opportunity Myth, focused on how schools are letting students down and how we collectively can fix it. How did you do your research and what did you learn?
Thank you. It's a great question. We actually came to that research because what we found is that across ed reform and education policy, lots of people asked the adults in the room what the experience of school was like. And we decided we really needed to harness student voice and leverage the student experience to inform us about policy changes that would be necessary. We followed about 4,000 students across the country, across 5 diverse districts, including rural, urban, and suburban, and 1 CMO. And our findings added up to the fact that there is an opportunity myth. And basically all that means is that there's this false promise that we as a society make to students and their families. And basically we tell them if students do what they're asked to do in school, they're set. They'll be set up for success. But we've actually misled families and students because what we found in our research is that quite often students are doing exactly what we ask them to do, but when they leave our K-12 buildings, they are not in fact ready for the next level.
What did you hear the students saying to you more specifically? Like, what were they not getting that they really needed?
What we found is that students have goals beyond high school, and almost regardless of their background, most of them intend to go to college or beyond. Upwards of 70% of them have a career goal that requires at least a 4-year degree. So it's not like the students have goals that are unrealistically tied to academic outcomes. They know that it's going to take their work both in college and in post-secondary and beyond to achieve those career goals. And so students were telling us that, but they also told us things like, I'm not sure if I'm ready. They would tell us that they weren't engaged in the lessons. And so what we did was actually we collected different data sources. We looked at students' grades. We looked at their standardized test scores. We observed their classrooms. We did surveys with students. We did surveys with teachers. And we triangulated all this data to come up with some findings that would tell us, okay, how would we go disrupting the opportunity myth that exists for students. and what will we need to do? And we found basically five key things. And those five key things were, number one, what I just said, that students have big, clear plans for college and career. The second thing we found is that most students do what they're asked to do in school, but they're still not ready to succeed after school. The third thing we found was that students actually spend most of their time without access to four key resources. And by that, I mean, we found four key things that make a difference as far as student outcomes. And those four things were access to grade appropriate assignments, access to strong instruction, deep engagement, and access to teachers with high expectations. We found that when students have access to those four key resources, their academic progress actually goes up significantly so. We also found, as a fourth thing though, too many students don't have access to those four resources, and it's exacerbated for students of color and students from low-income backgrounds. And then the fifth thing we found is that these four resources are not just nice to haves, meaning, oh, it would be great if students had access to strong instruction. No, we found in our research that access to those resources does improve student achievement, and it does so particularly for students who actually start out the year behind grade level. It flies in the face of some of what we hear sometimes from teachers, which is that I'm making my lessons more accessible to students by, I don't know how else to say it other than to say by dumbing down the lessons. But in fact, what we are doing is actually doing a disservice to those students.
Is there also a support component so that if the expectations are high, does there need to be high supports to go along with those expectations?
There are. One of the things that we found, though, in our research is that the four resources are interconnected. So what we found is that if you have a teacher that has high expectations, that teacher needs a rigorous curriculum to be able to implement and strong instructional materials to implement in order to help those students meet those expectations. One of the things, I'll give you an example of what I mean by this. In our research, we found this is a real example in a district where in an eighth grade classroom, one classroom in that district, general ed, eighth graders, were reading a grade appropriate text, meaning they were reading, you know, a nice thick chapter book that was on the eighth grade level. It happened to be The Mighty Long Way about the integration of Little Rock Central from Arkansas. That just happens to be an example. Those students were asked to read that text, write an essay. And so they were learning about history and they were having to do critical thinking and writing appropriate for eighth graders. In a different classroom in that same district, at about the same point in time, instead of that classroom doing similar work, this classroom read a worksheet. We think it was off, you know, Pinterest or teachers, paid teachers. It was not a part of the district approved curriculum. Some teacher had downloaded this worksheet. It was about oysters. And the students read the worksheet and their assignment was to complete multiple choice questions and then fill in the missing vowels to the word, for example, habitat.
Wow.
We're asking eighth graders to fill in the missing vowel to a word versus having them read a grade appropriate text, learn, critically think, analyze, and write. And this was in the same district. So that's what, when you ask the question about supports for schools that have rigorous materials and strong instructional materials, the support lies in making sure that teachers are actually trained and know how to utilize and implement the curriculum and are doing so versus thinking that, oh, my students aren't ready to do that type of work and thinking that they need to Google or go on Pinterest and find random assignments for those students to complete.
How do you think implicit bias intersects with all of this?
That was one of the questions that we had. What role did bias play? And The research was not intended to be a bashing of teachers, by no means. We did try to ascertain why were teachers making choices like that. And we hypothesized that there were a few things going on. There, in some cases, it may be that teachers simply didn't know how to implement the curriculum. So it's maybe a cry for help for more professional development for them. We hypothesized that it could be teachers taking the stance that if I go easy on my students, they'll go easy on me. My grandmother would call that laziness. We also hypothesized that there was some implicit and perhaps even explicit bias. And the reason I say that is because when we looked at the times when students were just given a chance to do grade level work, white students succeed at about the same rate as students of color. So this is, you know, irrespective of where they are, it's like, do they simply achieve when given a chance to do grade level work? And again, a little over half of the time they did. But when you look at the classroom composition, classrooms that were predominantly students of color were far less likely to have the chance to do those at-bats, as we call them. So for example, in a classroom that was majority students of color, about 38% of the time, they never got access to grade appropriate assignments. So never. This means that every single day they were doing worksheets like what I just described. Now, that same number for students that were predominantly white was 12%. So 12% of classrooms with predominantly white students got no access to grade appropriate assignments. So for me, that 12%, we're doing a disservice to those students. That 38% for students of color, that's educational malpractice. There's no other way to call it that. So we do believe there is bias going on, but it's not insurmountable, I guess is how I would describe from our findings.
Yeah, because that brought up two questions, whether it is implicit racial bias that teachers have in terms of their expectations of their students, and how much of it is racial bias in terms of the education funding itself, that the schools that have predominantly white children have better funding to access this better curriculum, whereas the schools that are serving families and students who live in poverty have predominantly students of color.
Well, you bring up a point, another thing that we found, because we wanted to dig a little deeper into that and see if the race of the teacher mattered at all. And what we actually found is that we asked teachers, do you believe in rigorous state standards for your students? And about 82% of the time, teachers said, yes, I believe in college-ready standards. I believe in, you know, these rigorous academic standards. But then when you follow up and probe a little deeply, and we ask those same teachers, you believe in the standards, do you believe that they're right for your students? That number drops down to about 44%. And when we looked at how that plays out in the classroom, what we found is that for classrooms with majority students of color, if the teacher shared the same race as the students, then about 66% of the time, that teacher had higher expectations. Now, when the race of the student and the teacher did not match, then that number drops down to only about 35% of the time. The teacher have high expectations. So is the headline, oh, go fire all your white teachers? No, that's not what we're saying at all. But we do know in our research, as well as other research has shown, all students, but particularly students of color, benefit from having access to a more diverse teacher population.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. So now that we have these findings, how can we fix this problem? Where are the levers? Is this something that we would do on the district level? Or is there something that we can do even on the state level to address some of these issues?
Yes, there are things that we can do on both levels and that we should be doing on both levels. We ask people to make two big commitments. Number one is to make sure that every student has access to those four resources: grade appropriate assignments, strong instruction, deep engagement, and teachers with high expectations. On our website, tntp.org, as you said, we actually give examples and we have what's called a student experience toolkit, which helps you know, how do you know that students have access to those resources? So I would argue that if you don't know, then you have to assume that students don't have those resources. So we published open source a way for districts to actually measure that. So we would push for that. And then the second commitment that we ask people to make is to make sure that every student and family is an authentic partner. For years, we as an education field have been misleading parents and students. We're telling them that, oh, you're doing great. We give them A's and B's, not knowing on the back end for a parent that, yes, my child got an A, but they got an A on a worksheet where they had to fill in missing vowels to the word habitat as an eighth grader. And if parents are more authentic partners with us, then I think we would have some real opportunities to stop misleading parents and to actually partner together to make sure that we together know what the goals are of students and their families and be more authentic about helping them achieve those goals.
Well, this is a really weird time for education right now, especially because of the pandemic. How has COVID-19 impacted ways of connecting with students and having this authentic engagement and even maintaining rigorous curriculum, because there's such a social emotional toll on students right now?
It is certainly a challenging time to be both a provider and a recipient in education. I have a fifth grader at home and I struggle. My son is attending school virtually right now. So I personally know that how challenging it is, as well as professionally. So I'm getting to live both of those lives. We actually have published some resources, again, they're on our website, that highlight some of the things that we should be focused on during this time. And I want to just emphasize 2 points. The first one is that we've made an overt push to districts to focus on acceleration versus remediation. When we talk to districts about reopening and reentry, there's a lot of conversations about learning loss and the notion that, oh, okay, we've got to remediate. Well, listening to what we learned in the opportunity myth and in the report, as soon as you start thinking remediation, you're more likely to go down that path of dumbing down lessons and work to help students make it more accessible instead of looking for opportunities to actually accelerate their learning by exposing them to more rigorous material. So it seems like it might be an oxymoron maybe to give students that may be behind more challenging work, but in fact, it actually helps them catch up. And as far as engaging with families, we actually published a guide, 5 essentials for engaging families and community partners. I mean, the first thing you have to do is reach out. I mean, we can't sit as educators and just sit on high and wait for parents and families to reach out to us. We've got to start a dialogue right away while plans are still being developed for opening, reopening, closing, reopening. Again, we know that this pandemic, unfortunately, is here with us for a while. We've got to continue to listen and assess our data about existing needs and gaps that exist. And then we actually have to develop a comprehensive education plan that leverages all of the resources that are available. So in other words, working with families and with community partners that are also playing a really big role now in providing supports to families, especially where schools are actually closed.
Yeah, and that's something that League of Education Voters certainly supports. Community building, authentic engagement on all levels is key to supporting our students at this time and in general too. So I'd like to ask you about your own educational journey. When you went through the education system, what worked and what didn't work so well?
I am fortunate. I grew up in a rural community, but I am fortunate to say that when I left K-12, I was prepared. My teachers knew me. They knew my context. They challenged me. I wasn't defined by my beginnings. I grew up in a really, like I said, rural setting, very poor. I lived in a house that didn't have indoor plumbing, for example, for the first 12 years of my life. That didn't define me. My teachers didn't look at me and say, oh, she's poor, she's a student of color, and so we need to make lessons more accessible to her. They challenged me knowing that my path, my family, and my plans included going beyond high school. I knew I wanted to go to college. I knew that that was a way out of poverty for me. And so my teachers supported my goals in doing that.
That is fantastic. Were there things that didn't work as well?
I had a really good K-12 experience. If I had to say one area that I may have struggled in some, we did, because of the teacher shortage, and you think about content areas, there were some content areas where you could tell that we probably could have had a teacher who had better content knowledge. And that showed up for me just, you know, in a small way, but that showed up for me when I got to college. Not such that it held me back, but I did have to work a little harder than some of my peers who may have had access to teachers who had stronger content knowledge in some, especially at the, you know, at the secondary level, some of those subjects.
Yeah, which goes right back to that opportunity myth report. I mean, you lived it in so many ways.
Yes, I did.
Well, if you were in charge of our education system, whether it's on a national level or a state level, and you had no budget restraints whatsoever, what would you do?
I would make sure that every student had access to a teacher that had high expectations for them and had the skills to enact those expectations, meaning they had their content knowledge. So we train up teachers, we pay enough, make sure more and more teachers went into the field, more diverse teachers that went into the field, and they would implement really strong instructional materials with every student. They would be culturally responsive. They would make sure that students were getting good social emotional learning alongside it. And they would push students alongside their families and parents to achieve the goals that they set for themselves. And the second thing that I would really ensure alongside that, I'm really interested in making sure students have social capital. We find now students, even those students that are prepared and go to college, we know that persistence rates aren't where they need to be. There's a lot of research now out on social capital. And so I would also make sure that some way we figured out how to infuse good programming that helps students have social capital, which I think is really key to persistence. Career paths aren't linear. So if we acknowledge that in the way that we train and prepare students, I think we would do a much better job.
So basically every student would have a learning community around them?
They would, and it would be multi-pronged. A really effective teacher would be at the core, but there would be other supports wrapped around those students working alongside those teachers.
Well, that would be fantastic.
That would be fantastic. And I think it's doable. We're seeing more and more pushes for rigorous materials. We're seeing more and more pushes for social emotional learning supports, more supports around mental health, around trauma for students. So I think it's possible. It will take investments, but our students deserve nothing less.
Dr. Tugwilla Brownie is Executive Vice President of Strategy, Policy, and Community Coalitions at TNTP. Read the Opportunity Myth Report at tntp.org. Dr. Brownie, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. To learn more about League of Education Voters or to support our work, please visit educationvoters.org.